Before I begin today, just a couple of notes. First, I'm sure you're aware there is an impending final exam in a couple of weeks. I've gotten a couple of emails asking about the exam, so let me just say very briefly a little bit about it. The exam will be almost entirely, about 80% of it, over this third part of the course, but there will be questions reviewing the most important ideas from the first two parts of the course. So it's best if you don't forget everything that we covered in the first 10 or 11 weeks of the semester. The exam will have the same structure as it had this time, the last time. And as in the earlier exams, it will not be a timed exam. So again, if anyone does need time, extra time, we'll have arrangements for you to continue taking the exam. I suppose it'll mean going to a different room in the social science building. Finals are scheduled over a longer period than a conventional class, so I really it's just not anywhere close to a two-hour exam. It'll be about the same, just a slightly longer than the midterms because of the extra material on the first two parts of the course. One other just little thing. I have office hours on two more Thursdays. A number of you have come to see me, not necessarily to complain about an exam or to discuss some narrow issue in the class, but just to have a chance to chat. And I would really like to see more of you. So I'll be in my office today and Thursday as open office hours. And if by chance the reason you haven't come is because those particular times aren't convenient, just shoot me an email and we'll figure out another time. One final thing before we begin. There was a news report this morning that was very poignant, saddening, which I thought I would just briefly mention because it's not getting much coverage, but it's symptomatic of a certain general problem, some of which we've touched on in the class. And the particular report was on the way in which yesterday, it was reported today, I'm assuming this happened yesterday, that the Senate blocked ratification of the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. So the United Nations has a series of conventions. The most famous is the UN Convention on Human Rights, which was formed right after the Second World War. It's a magnificent statement about the deepest shared values of the contemporary world around the issue of human rights. And there have been subsequent conventions that have been ratified, some by the United States, some by many other countries, with the United States abstaining. There was a UN Convention on the Rights of Women, a UN Convention on the Rights of Children. The only two countries that haven't ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of Children are the United States and Somalia, I believe. Every other country has ratified it. We haven't. Blocked in the Senate is the problem. Now, the rights of people with disability, it has this deep irony. The United States passed the initial legislation was passed in the 70s, and then it was strengthened in the 80s. In an extremely strongly bipartisan way, we passed domestically the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is one of the strongest pieces of legislation anywhere in the world about how accommodations have to be made for people with various kinds of disabilities. This blocking of this UN convention yesterday in the Senate reminds me that I should have actually talked about the American for Disability Acts as one of the positive achievements in the United States in the last several decades. I tend to focus on where we fall short of the ideals of justice, equality, democracy, and so on. But on the issue of disability rights, we've gone very far in saying all citizens should have equal capacity to navigate physically the world and to find employment, and that discrimination against people with disabilities and physical barriers to mobility for people with disabilities are not something which we will tolerate any longer in the United States. So the U.S. has very good, strong legislation, some of which turns out to benefit everybody. So I'm sure you notice curb cuts. Now, throughout most of your lives, curb cuts have just been a natural thing. You have sidewalks, and there's a cut at the end for people with wheelchairs. Until the 1970s, there were no curb cuts, or at least they were extremely rare. You can imagine what a barrier that makes to somebody in a wheelchair just simply going down the street. But it's also a barrier for parents with strollers. It also makes pushing a baby buggy much tougher if you've got to navigate curbs. Curb cuts is the result of the Americans for Disabilities Act. So we are a world leader on this. What the UN Convention basically does is an announcement that all countries should follow the American standard. All of the provisions in the UN Declaration on the Rights of People with Disabilities, all of them except for one, come straight from the Americans for Disabilities Act. Now, the one that doesn't come from the Americans for Disabilities Act was the justification for blocking it in the Senate. That provision says that public policy concerning children with disabilities should place the interests of the child at the forefront. Now, that seems pretty reasonable. If you're going to have policies around disabilities specifically towards children, the interests of the child should guide the policy. That's what was objected to by conservatives in the Senate. And their argument was that provision would enable the U.S. government to ban homeschooling for children with disabilities if the U.S. government decided that that wasn't the best interest of the child. Now, to me, that's a kind of just crazy interpretation of an affirmation of a principle, of a value. It seems just to me transparent that the interests of the child should be foremost in our concerns, not the interests of other parties. And the idea that you should block this entire convention, not ratify it, say we reject it because of that very far-fetched constructed objection, just to me is an absurdity. It goes beyond my simply disagreeing with the opposition. I do, of course, disagree with them. But it's a sort of Alice in Wonderland view of the nature of the stakes and the issues here. And the irony is, we impose lots of costs on businesses in the United States because of the Americans for Disability Act. It's why some businessmen object to it, because it's expensive. You have to accommodate people. It poses costs on the University of Wisconsin. We have to accommodate students that have various kinds of physical limitations, ranging from various kinds of cognitive issues around test taking, for example. That's covered under the heading of the Americans with Disability Act. I ran a program last year in which we showed a film about deaf poets, and I wanted to invite people from the Madison deaf community to the university to watch this fantastic film about deaf poetry, poetry done with sign language. Brilliant film. And I was told and accepted the implications that to do that I had to hire a sign interpreter for the entire evening so that the deaf members of the audience and deaf students who came to it, since it was a event to be inclusive of them, that they wouldn't be disadvantaged in being able to fully participate. That was expensive. It's an expense imposed on us by this law, which I think is a very good law. So the irony in this case is American businesses would be better off if all businesses in the world had to face the same costs, right? That's the problem with imposing regulations, is that if you do it for some business and not for others, it means they have extra costs. And the UN, the American Senate has said, we don't want to ratify this UN convention for the reasons I announced. Now, of course, ratifying a convention doesn't automatically create laws elsewhere. The way UN conventions work is they create global moral standards. It's part of an effort to create a global consensus around certain issues. And that then becomes a lever within countries for people who are mobilizing to change their laws to say, look, you signed on to the convention. Now let's see you follow through with laws. It gives leverage. And with the United States not ratifying the convention, it undermines the symbolic unity of that particular effort. Well, I wanted to share that with you just because it was upsetting to me when I read about it in the New York Times this morning. It's one example of many such things that sort of privately drive me crazy. It's hard enough being on the left-wing fringe when you just have genuine opposition that you understand, yes, there's different interests involved, we have a clash of principles, you win some, you lose some. Okay, that's the messy business of democracy. It's another thing when the reasons you lose certain kinds of things have nothing really to do with the substance of what's in play. They have to do with these very extraneous kinds of issues. Well, back to our subjects at hand. I want to finish the discussion on militarism. Where we left off, I had just gone through this list of motivations for the kind of global reach of American military power. And in the course of that, I reviewed a total of five motivations, which I won't repeat here. What I'd like to just briefly touch on to end that discussion is the question of consequences. So we live in a society within which the military plays this very decisive role. In everyday life, for most people, this is in the background. There's a sort of shadow of militarism in our daily life. Although some Americans, of course, it affects very deeply, that this is the way we relate to the rest of the world. What I'd like to summarize here, then, are what I think are the deeper, longer-term consequences of this way of organizing the relationship of our society to the particular problem of national defense. First consequence. To state it in the strongest possible terms, the first consequence is a tendency towards perpetual war as a feature of our relationship to the rest of the world. We engage constantly in the development of new technologies to wage war, and particularly and understandably, technologies that are designed to reduce U.S. casualties in warfare, which then have the ironic effect of making military intervention even easier. So, of course, it's completely understandable. And, you know, I can't say with a straight face, I wish there were more U.S. casualties. Of course not. I don't want there to be more casualties in a war. But there is this irony. The fewer the casualties, the more you can impose damage on others at low cost to yourself, the lower the threshold for intervening because you don't face costs. It's another irony in my own life. You know, during the Vietnam War, when I was a student, I was a strong opponent of the Vietnam War, and I campaigned against the military draft. The military draft, however, had a positive feature. It meant that when the United States engaged in war, it touched very broadly and deeply the entire population. The all-volunteer army is something that I struggled for. I said, this is the way we should have a military. You shouldn't force people to engage in the military, but I kind of doubt if the current military adventures in Iraq would have been possible if we had a draft. If all of the, there's only one senator or congressman, I believe. This may be a slight overstatement, but it's at most only a slight overstatement. There's only one that has a soldier in combat as a child. It's a very different world when you're making policy that affects everybody, rather than just affects people who, for whatever reasons, choose to be part of the military organizations in the United States. So the draft and new technologies that reduce our casualties, all of this makes war easier, not harder, makes intervention a less costly thing to do. And this is sometimes done even when these new forms of intervention have what is euphemistically called collateral damage. I'm sure many of you have been who read the news are aware of the increasing use of unmanned drones to engage in military strikes in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Military drones are kind of the pure example of this, a form of engaging in combat where you don't put your own people in harm's way. Military drones are operated by controllers who may be halfway around the world. They may be sitting in a comfortable, may or may not be comfortable, I don't know what the seating arrangements are, but in an office in the United States controlling remotely drones that are operating in the Middle East. And there have been many instances in which the drones hit the wrong target, or the nature of the damage inflicted by the drones causes great damage to surrounding people, including, of course, civilians in communities that are not in any way involved in the actual combat. Now, of course, in general, it's the case that warfare causes death and destruction to people who are not themselves implicated in the war. That's a almost universal feature of contemporary war. But when that happens in a context where there are no costs to the people who are engaged in the warfare itself, no costs in the financial costs, but no personal costs, it just makes the whole process and social feedback process of evaluating when you should and shouldn't do these things, I think, much weaker. And that contributes to this pattern of perpetual warfare. These kinds of aggressive interventionist postures around the world provokes reactions. I mean, how could it not provoke reactions? Reactions in response to our interventions. Chalmers Johnson, this political scientist who was a very strong supporter of the Cold War that I mentioned last time, Chalmers Johnson refers to this as the problem of blowback. That at least to some extent, terrorism is a response to militarism. Now, that is not the same as saying terrorism is justified. This isn't a moral argument that terrorists are justified in what they do because of bad things that we do. No, I'm not. I am not of the two wrongs make a right school of moral life. Terrorism is morally reprehensible, but it's comprehensible. It can be reprehensible and comprehensible, and partially explained as a reaction to our own actions. That doesn't necessarily mean that our actions are not themselves justified. Sometimes that's just part of the costs you have to bear. If you're doing something that is justified, is to risk provoking violent reaction. But it at least should give people pause in thinking about the long-term consequences for our way of life and the kind of society we have of a regime of perpetual war, if part of a regime of perpetual war is to trigger and foster perpetual retaliation. The terrorism then itself provides justifications for further intervention and militarism. This is what's called a vicious cycle. I'm sure you've heard that expression. It's hard to imagine a clearer case of a vicious cycle. You build an economy rooted in militarism, you create all sorts of interests in expanding military, you engage in interventions which provoke reactions that provide justifications once again for militarism. That's the first cluster of consequences. The second is the direct implication for democracy. Perpetual war undermines democracy at home. War itself is always in tension with democracy. War requires discipline. It justifies emergency measures. It creates a context where extraordinary powers of political authority are considered legitimate. So war is always in tension with democracy. Even when the democratic population wants and supports a war, it's always a tension, at least, with democratic life. Perpetual war becomes a serious erosion of democratic principles. Perpetual war leads to an increasing power in the presidency. The president can basically bring us to war virtually on his or her own initiative. Military priorities are bolstered by intensified fear. And people are more willing to give up civil liberties when they are afraid. Part of perpetual war is perpetual fear. It's creating a climate of politics in which people are responding to anxieties and threats as being the centerpiece of how they think about political action. The Patriot Act, I think, is an example of this. The Patriot Act created enormous new powers for the central government, in ways that rendered those powers virtually unaccountable to civil authority, to democratic authority, I should say, and which was justified on the grounds of the emergency and extraordinary conditions under which the United States faced after the 9/11 attacks. Militarism is at the center of a politics of fear. Militarism also preempts other kinds of state activity, of democratic activity. It imposes big constraints on budgets and thus curtails the scope of democratic deliberation over the public good. If you've got a huge military budget and you're able to defend that military budget as sacrosanct because of the politics of fear, so that cuts in the military is viewed as unpatriotic, then that puts huge constraints on your ability to allocate public resources for other purposes, whatever those purposes might be, including education, health, infrastructure, the arts, you name it. And finally, in terms of the effect on democracy, militarism undermines democratic political culture. In debates over domestic priorities, people can see their opponents as legitimate opponents, and they can work out compromises. You know, with respect to issues around domestic priorities, historically, at least in the United States, there's give and take, and people are able to be persuaded about the importance of finding some kind of middle ground. That's why something like the American for Disabilities Act, which is a pretty radical act, you know, it really embodies this principle that all people should have equal access to the conditions to live a flourishing life. That's a pretty strong view about equality, the American Disabilities Act. And it says, and we all collectively have to bear the costs of making that happen. You know, that was an act that corresponds exactly, if I may say, to the values which I feel should govern public policy around questions of justice and equality. Well, we could do that on a domestic front. On foreign policy issues involving the military, debates escalate deeply, and opponents are often treated like traitors. It's not mere differences of opinion. It becomes good and evil. Military culture, when a political culture becomes itself militarized, civility with respect to working out compromises and mutual understanding by people who occupy different political positions, that is itself eroded. Well, I'll leave both on. Number three, the degradation of information. Information warfare and deception are official policies in periods of warfare. Information distortion, lying, deception become official public policy of the government in times of warfare. The war in Iraq is a stunning example of this. The war was justified on the grounds that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and if we did not invade Iraq, we risked having biological, chemical, and even nuclear war in the United States. That was stated. The people who said that, I don't believe, believed it. The evidence was, there was essentially no good evidence for it. And there were plenty of people, including the UN arms inspectors who had been in Iraq, who said there is no evidence for the presence of weapons of mass destruction. And indeed, when we occupied Iraq, we found no evidence whatsoever for weapons of mass destruction. That was the justification of the war. you know, that the justification for the war, again, the Iraq war, was not we have to topple a nasty dictator. That wasn't the justification. The justification was we needed to do it because there was a direct and imminent threat against the United States. And that was not true. Now, one view is that was a mistake. It was an error, a failure of intelligence. I personally don't believe that at all. I think it's just not plausible, given the international debate at the time, given the fact that UN inspectors said, no, this is not true. And there were dissenters in the US, high-level dissenters, people who were previously involved in the CIA, people who were retired military, who said, there is no evidence for this. Well, that's not surprising that there was deception. That's part of what military politics does. It justifies policies and distorts information in order to gain support for those policies. This was also true in the Vietnam War, as we now know. The famous Gulf of Tonkin resolution, the incident in the Gulf of Tonkin, which was used to justify the major escalation of the war in the Johnson administration, the actors at the time knew that that incident did not occur. It's not that they were mistaken and overreacted. They knew it wasn't true. But they saw it as an opportunity by distorting what happened and describing it in incorrect ways as a way of gaining public support for a major escalation of the war. When you combine this general tendency for the government to engage in deliberate, systematic deception of its own people during times of war, and you combine that with corporate control over the media, which we've discussed before, as another problem about the quality of information, you can see why a world of perpetual war and a militarized economy underwrites a really deep crisis in the quality of information available and needed for a robust democracy. And finally, I mean, if these three aren't serious enough consequences of perpetual militarism, there's the issue of national bankruptcy. This, of course, is a big topic politically today. The dominant view that's being propounded is that the problem of state spending and its escalation over time is rooted in what are called entitlements, basically Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, programs that provide help to the poor and to people with limited resources, that's the source of our escalating government spending, rather than the chronic source of militarism and the huge military budget. When we spend nearly half of the global spending on the military, that to me seems at least as significant a part of whatever deficit problems we have as entitlements for people who are disadvantaged and living at low levels and needing public support in one way or another. There's a looming economic catastrophe in the United States because of the national debt. It is a problem, but I think the problem is rooted as much in militarism as it is in any of the domestic priorities in which the U.S. state is involved. I received an email from a student in the class, a thoughtful email, about the figures I gave in the last lecture and that are in the book about the scale of military spending. Because if you look at the Congressional Budget Office's accounting system, how they divide up the budget, the military spending is much lower than what I reported. Part of the issue there is what do you count under the military budget? Do you just look narrowly at the current year's congressionally authorized Department of Defense budget, or do you look at all budgetary items that are bound up with supporting the military operations of the United States? So I included, and when I say I these figures were from various research centers that study these things. I didn't do the calculations myself. I included in the military budget interest payments on previous wars and previous loans acquired for military activities. So if you have interest on previous loans, those count as part of your military expenditures, even though they're not in the budget of the Department of Defense. Also, the Department of Defense budget does not include the supplementary appropriations that go to fund particular military activities. So the Department of Defense's budget is for the core budget for national defense, but not for all the additional expenses that occur when you have extraordinary expenses, such as in the current period. There's also then questions, should the Veterans Administration expenses be included as part of the military budget? They're not in the Department of Defense's budget, but they are, I think, legitimately seen as part of the budget, broadly understood, that is the result of the nature of our military establishment. I have, of course, an irony in that respect, because I think the Veterans Administration is a fantastically good organization. It does an extraordinarily good job in health care, and it should be a kind of model for a national health program rather than a niche dealing with the military. Nevertheless, I think it should properly be included under a broadly understood military budget. So when I get the budget up in that pie chart where it was, I believe, 40%+ of the total budget, that's including all of these supplementary and collateral expenses that are tied to the military. It's not just the Department of Defense budget. Okay. On to the next topic. Now, this topic is tapping into some broader themes than just the narrow issue of the labor movement and unions. I think unions are a perfectly interesting theme in their own right, but I'm going to treat the issue of unions as a particular site for discussing a much broader question about the nature of democratic institutions and what it takes to have a vibrant democracy. And this concerns a kind of simple and fundamental aspect of any democratic society. Namely, we live in a world where individuals live as separate persons. And if they are to act politically in a democracy, they have to have some way of forming associations. Democracies are vibrant when people act jointly rather than they simply act as separate persons. And what I'm going to argue is that unions are an extremely important example of how this comes about. I'm going to focus on the political life of unions rather than just their narrowly economic condition. So here's the basic way to frame this overall problem. Rule by the people as a general idea means rule by the will of the people. The will of the people has to be translated into public purposes of the state. That's what a democracy means. So that's a simple kind of point. I don't think a controversial one. If democracy means rule by the people, the people have to somehow form a will, a purpose, which then gets translated into policy. The problem then is how to form a genuine will of the people and how to translate it into public policy. And here's the obstacle. We live in a highly atomized society of separate competing individuals pursuing their individual interests, facing numerous free rider problems. A market economy encourages that. A market economy is grounded on the idea that economic life will go better if people compete with each other. If people try to win and other people inevitably lose. Competition is competition. Market societies tend to atomize communities. That expression, atomize, is evoking, it's a metaphor, of course, It's invoking the idea that each person is a separate entity unto him or herself. Every person is a separate entity. And they exist in the world as atoms bumping into each other, rather than as collectives in one form or another. So we live in a world where people are atomized. That's just one of the facts of the kind of societies we live in. And yet, democracy requires that they get together and constitute themselves as some kind of people with a common set of purposes. And as we know from our discussions at various times, all of this is fraught with the problem of free riding. This is the collective action problem, the prisoner's dilemma, all of the problems that are connected to the difficulty of overcoming the separateness of persons in order for them to collaborate in a robust way for political and other purposes. The solution to this problem is the formation of various kinds of organizations that are directly integrated into people's ordinary lives and concerns. The solution to this atomization problem is the formation of associations that are integrated into the mundane lives of people and which help to build solidarities and collective capacities. And there's all sorts of ways this can happen. Here are just a few examples. Unions are one. That's what I'll discuss today. Community-based civic associations would be another one. Civic associations, whether it's the Rotary Club or other kinds of civic associations, these are embedded in communities. People get together, they talk to each other, they overcome their isolated separateness through dialogue and interaction. And that's the process by which they begin to form a collective will rather than just an individual will. Churches are another good example. In the United States, I think one could say that at various times in history, churches have been the most important site by which these kinds of collective solidarities for political purposes have been forged. The abolition movement in the 19th century was to a very significant extent anchored in religious communities. And churches being the kind of physical place where people would get together, not as isolated persons, but as members of an association. So unions then are one type of solution to this more general problem. This whole issue is embedded in a set of abstract sociological ideas, which I just want to very briefly touch on. This is part of your vocabulary building exercise in this class, increasing your understanding of different ways that social theorists, sociologists, and others try to understand how the world works in order to make certain problems clearer. Sociological discussions usually center of this sort, center around a term that's called civil society. You may have heard that expression. We haven't used it very much in this class, I think perhaps at times in passing. It's an important part of contemporary social thinking. When you think about American society, about a society, using that word society, the idea here is that societies can be broken down into a number of different overlapping spheres of social processes. Now, this is all very loosey-goosey language, sphere. What does a sphere mean? You know, spheres are round. Society doesn't have a shape in which there are round bits in it. Sociologists and social theorists struggle for language to express these ideas. Sometimes it's called domains, sometimes spheres, sometimes just processes. Don't get hung up on that kind of linguistic problem. Just think about society as involving a number of different ways in which people interact with each other to accomplish their purposes. These different ways in which people interact can be called spheres, and all of which interconnect to constitute what we call a society. Now, three of these are particularly important. The economy, and I'll use the word sphere here for want of a better expression. The economy is the sphere in which we produce and buy things to satisfy our needs. The state is the sphere in which we govern our collective affairs. And civil society is the sphere where we get together voluntarily in association with each other to pursue common purposes. That's what civil society is. Civil society is all the different ways in which we get together voluntarily to form associations in pursuit of some kind of common purpose. Churches, I think, are a classic and paradigmatic example of an association in civil society. Members of a faith get together for religious purposes, but to strengthen their bonds and ties and sense of connectivity to each other in pursuit of those purposes. That's why I think for some people, certain tendencies in the organization of modern churches, where churches seem more like commercial enterprises selling a product to their members. You know, some of the mega churches in the suburbs of certain cities, where it seems much more like going to the theater and being sold, or a mall even. Indeed, there are some mega churches that have malls all around them just for that purpose. You go to church and then you go shopping, and it's just seen as a piece, as part of a set of activities. Well, many religious people find that pretty disturbing, and it's a very different model of church as a community of people that associate in common purpose to build solidarities, to do things, not just to be exposed to particular messages. Now, here's the big point about this issue. A vibrant democracy depends in important ways upon a vibrant civil society. A vibrant democracy depends on a vibrant civil society. A vibrant civil society is one in which it is easy rather than difficult for people to form collective associations to pursue collective purposes. So you've got, this is a kind of a nice sort of interconnected ideas. A vibrant democracy needs a vibrant civil society. A vibrant civil society is one in which it is easy rather than difficult for people to form these associations that are necessary in order for them to act jointly and collectively. Now, what does it mean to make it easy rather than hard to form associations? It's easy to form associations when those associations are what could be described as organic, embedded in the ordinary lives of people. When they're just part of the way you live your life, the associations intersect the way you live your life. And churches satisfy that in religious communities. The way you live your life as a ordinary person living in a community of faith is to participate in religious ceremony. And churches then become connected to the mundane lives of people in that way. This is why unions have a very special standing with respect to associations, because they're embedded in the workplace. People go to work. It's part of your everyday life. Whether you have unions or not, it's part of your everyday life as an adult to look for a job, when you get a job, to go to work, to get a paycheck, to interact with fellow workers, to take instructions from your boss, to do the tasks of the workplace. That's just part of life. It's what people do. And a union is an association that's connected to that everyday lifeness of people. And that's why they're different, really, from just a club. You know, they're different from other sorts of associations that people might form because they're interested in it. This is an association that's embedded. The word embedded is used sometimes for this. That's embedded in the everyday lives of people. And the other important aspect is it's embedded in the everyday lives of people who often are in other respects relatively disadvantaged. It's embedded in the everyday lives of people that lack power, the everyday lives of people that are just ordinary folks. And that's why it serves this or it potentially serves this really important aspect for creating a vibrant civil society for democratic purposes. Well, let's now turn more specifically to unions. This little framework, the economy, the state, civil society, that's a very general framework that sociologists use these days to describe all sorts of phenomena. Those of you who go on in sociology, you'll encounter discussions of civil society and how it works, what are the conditions that make it vibrant or fragmented and fractured. This is one of the big themes of contemporary sociological discussion. So now let's look at what unions are. The conventional view is that unions are a special kind of interest organization that looks out for the narrow economic interests of their members at the expense of everybody else. The standard view in the popular media in the United States is that unions are a special interest group, that when unions stand up and make a demand, they are making demands in the narrow interests of their members. End of story. Some people think that unions mainly benefit union leaders. So the kind of further denigrating view of unions is that they don't even serve the interests of their members. They just serve the interests of union officials. With this conventional view, the decline of unions in the United States over the last half century is explained as reflecting simply the preferences of people. Workers have come to realize that unions are not serving their interests, and they simply don't want to be bothered with them. The decline of unions simply reflects the low level of unionization in the United States simply reflects the individualistic character of American workers. That's, I think, the conventional view. An alternative view, the view that I will be discussing, and which I believe is more accurate, sees unions as a basis for a more egalitarian system of power relations. And this is true for both in terms of economic power and political power. First, let me just mention very briefly economic power. It's not what I'm going to mainly talk about. Workers are, as individuals, disadvantaged in bargaining in labor markets with employers. Just think about the nature of power and what it means. Power in a market depends upon how costly it is for a person to back away from a deal. All right, so that's if you're engaged in a market bargaining relationship, how much power you have depends upon how costly it is to you to say no, how costly it is to exit the bargain. In general, in most circumstances, employers have many potential employees that can be hired for most jobs. And usually it hurts an employee more to be fired than it hurts an employer for an individual employee to quit. That is, usually the costs to the employer of firing a worker is much less than the cost to an employer than the cost to the individual of being fired. And this means that employers have more power than workers do. Now, it doesn't mean that it's more costly for the employer to have the entire labor force that it employs quit, go on strike. That's very costly for an employer. It's just not very costly for an employer for an individual worker to quit. What a union does, then, is combine the individually weak power, labor market power of each member, and joins them together in a collective organization, which is able then to bargain with employers on collective terms, not just individual terms. And that just moves some of the way towards equalizing the power relations between employers and employees. This is illustrated in a table that's in the paper, in the chapter in the book, which compares the average wages of union and non-union workers in a variety of low-wage occupations. In low-wage occupations, in general, unions are able to get for their members wages that are in the 30 to 40% higher than those workers would receive in the absence of a union. That's the economic power. So unions help to equalize economic power between workers who individually are weak in the labor market, but collectively may not be so weak, the power relations with potential employers. But I think for the purposes of today's discussion, the more important issue is the political power, the issue of political power. Unions also help to solve the problem of powerless individuals in democratic politics. Isolated, atomized individual citizens are likely to be passive, apathetic political forces. The problem of rational ignorance. Remember rational ignorance? If you don't remember, you should review it. It's the kind of concept I might just ask on the exam in a couple of weeks. That's not a, I'm not dropping an actual prediction. I'm just saying it's the sort of thing that I might well ask you. Remember rational ignorance. Rational ignorance means people in general in politics get their information on the cheap. And unions help to solve the rational ignorance problem by providing relevant information for workers by virtue of their status as workers in the economy. Unions also foster a sense of civic obligation, which also increases the sense in which people feel more empowered to participate in politics. Unions contribute to political power in, whoops, that's not the right next slide. We'll go back to that. Unions contribute to political power in really two ways. One is unions help build what I've called organic solidarities. People are in their workplaces. Unions help to turn their participation in workplaces, which is already an important part of people's lives, into a basis for collective action. That is, they help to build solidarity among people within a workplace because it enables people to act on their common interests within workplaces. And unions also help to build organizational capacity. They build a bridge between individuals and electoral politics. They make it easier for people to work in campaigns and thus counteract the role of money in elections. If you want to think about electoral politics, there's basically two sorts of resources that get deployed in politics, time and money. Wealthy people contribute to politics, and how much money they contribute depends upon their willingness to pay. Right? So one of the reasons we have a lot of money in politics from rich people is because rich people are highly willing to spend a lot of money in politics. And the reason they're prepared to spend a lot of money in politics is that it doesn't constitute a sacrifice. If you're rich enough, it's all discretionary income that you're not going to consume anyway. And investing in politics is a pretty good investment. Willingness to pay is the main way that wealthy people participate in politics. For ordinary people, their willingness to participate in politics depends upon their willingness to act, depends upon their willingness to devote time to politics. And unions make it easier for people to do that. In the recent election for president and for other political offices, unions played an important role in mobilizing people, making it easy for them to engage in canvassing and telephoning and in all the other activities that require time, but not money, to conduct elections. So these are why unions are important politically for democracy, not just economically for the interests of their particular members. Let's now briefly take a tour through the history of the labor movement in the United States. Unions potentially play this important role in creating organic solidarities and capacities for political action in civil society. Let's just do a quick tour. This is elaborated in more detail in the book over how this developed in the course of American history. So the first point to note is that throughout American history, unions are embedded in a tense relationship between two kinds of values which govern American society, which are important in American society. Both of these values are important. First, freedom of association. That's an important value. People should have the right to form associations as they please. And the second is freedom of voluntary exchange in a market. Everybody should be allowed to buy and sell whatever they want in a market. Right? Freedom, individual freedom in the market to engage in exchange is one value. And the freedom to form associations is another. Until well into the 20th century, unions were seen as a coercive restriction on voluntary contracts. So until well into the 20th century, the dominant view in the courts was that unions violated the second of these values, that interfered with voluntary exchange in the market. And therefore, laws which restrict union activities are defended under the banner, the right to work. If you hear that expression, the right to work laws, what right to work laws mean is that you want a law that gives people the right to work even if they don't want to be part of a union. The expression right to work refers to all laws which restrict the capacity of unions to interfere with voluntary exchange between workers and employers. You can imagine if you're going to have a union and union members have to pay dues, right? I mean, unions need resources. And the employer wants to hire somebody who's not a union member to do the job that union members are doing. Many people who are not yet part of a union, who don't share those solidarities, are going to say, well, look, I can get a job at this wage, and then I won't have to pay the union dues. I'll be better off. What the right to work laws say is employers can hire non-union members even if they have a union contract with the union. Well, you can see why that makes it really tough on the union, because new hires will generally, or often, prefer to not join the union because it's cheaper for them. They'll make more money. They'll get the same wage as union workers, but won't have to pay the union dues. So the right to work law, which is based on that second value, basically undermines the capacity of unions to form voluntary to form associations capable of bargaining on behalf of workers. So those two values are present throughout American history. Unions always, in the 19th century, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, unions face a fundamental problem in how to get formed and how to organize, which centers on the vulnerability of organizers and members. And here's the basic way to think about this. For a union to be strong, it needs a high proportion of workers in a firm to be members. There's strength in numbers. That's the whole point of a union. There's strength in numbers. All unions begin as weak organizations. Now, it's kind of a logical point. If you're going to build a union in a workplace that doesn't have a union, you begin as a weak organization, an organization without members. And that's the problem. How can a union grow from a small to big organization, from weak to strong? When a union is weak, individuals are extremely vulnerable. You know, if you have a weak union and the boss finds out you're organizing to join and build a union, what's to prevent the employer from simply firing everybody who is talking about a union? Unless there's some restriction on how employers treat potential union members, it becomes extremely risky for people to even begin to organize a union. This makes it very hard for unions to grow slowly and incrementally. unless there are legal protections enforced by the state. Those legal protections are referred to as labor law. They're the laws which protect the capacity of people to form unions. And this means a central problem for any labor movement is creating a favorable legal framework for union organizing. In the absence of that framework, it's just extremely tough to go from small to big, because in that process, the people engaged in organizing unions are just too vulnerable to retaliation by employers. In the 19th century, there were no protections to the right to form a union. Employers could just fire a worker the moment a worker said to fellow workers, "Let's form a union." That would be grounds for firing. The breakthrough for this process occurred in the New Deal in the 1930s. The law that consolidated a set of rules that would protect people forming a union is called the Wagner Act. And it's really the most important piece of labor legislation in American history. It set up a whole series of requirements and regulations. These are discussed in the chapter in the book. I won't go through them in detail here. The key idea of the Wagner Act is to make it difficult for employers to retaliate against employees if those employees begin talking about forming some kind of collective organization. It's meant to restrict the power of employers to fire people, to retaliate in any way for people who want to form a collective association. Now, that is an interference with private property. This is important to understand. To protect the right of people to form an association amongst themselves in a context of the workplace means you have to restrict the power and rights of people who are owners. There's no two ways about it. You cannot leave absolute dictatorial power in the hands of employers by virtue of their private property. You just can't leave that intact if you're going to allow people to form associations. The two cannot go together without putting some kind of restriction on the power of employers. That's why employers fought this bitterly. Now, the restriction on the power of employers to fire workers doesn't guarantee that workers will form unions. It just means that they can do so without being threatened with their livelihood in the process of attempting to. The Wagner Act also required, and this is a tougher requirement, it's less clear exactly what it means. It's pretty clear what it means not to fire somebody. What's a little less clear is what it means once a union gets formed. If a union does get formed, the Wagner Act also requires that employers engage in what's called good faith bargaining. That is, once a union is formed, they have to engage in serious good faith bargaining over contracts with the union. Good faith is a pretty loose term, and it's been a source of great contention throughout this process. The result of the Wagner Act was a really stunning increase in unionization in the United States. Unionization before the 1930s hovered between 10 and 15% of the labor force. And mostly those unions were in the skilled trades, like carpentry, plumbing, and other kind of skilled trades associations. That's what they were called. With the Wagner Act, unions dramatically increased, reaching a peak of close to 35% of the labor force. After World War II, a series of changes in the Wagner Act were passed, which ultimately eroded the strength of unions in the United States. These amendments were called the Taft-Hartley Amendments, passed in the late 1940s. I won't again go into the details of exactly how these new rules were in place, but the most important is that they allowed for what are called right-to-work laws, which in many states had the effect of basically blocking the ability of unions to stably organize a workplace. In the absence of right-to-work laws, once a union is established in a workplace, every new employee has to join the union. Now, that's a bit of coercion against the employee, right? It's a law that says you're forced to join an association if you want a job once the union is in place in that workplace. The way you should think about it in theoretical terms is such a law that is requiring workers to join unions prevents them from being free riders. You see, if you don't force people to join the union, then it's very tempting to let other people make the sacrifice of a strong collective association to bargain for higher wages and to be a free rider, not join, don't have to pay the dues, but you get all the benefits. You get all the benefits of the union in bargaining higher wages and better working conditions, but you don't have to pay for it. Well, what the original Wagner Act allowed was for unions, for workers to be required to join unions once the union contract was established. And that stabilized the union in the workplace. The right to work laws undermine that capacity. The result of that is the steep decline of unions since its peak in the 1950s. Today, overall unionization rates are in the vicinity of 12%, but it's much lower in the private sector. That includes public sector unions. The erosion of unions after World War II began with the Taft-Hartley laws. They intensified in the course of the 1970s and 1980s, and intensified in a number of critical ways. Laws are not self-enforcing, so we do have laws that still protect unions. Employers are not allowed to fire somebody for trying to organize a union. But what happens when an employer does fire somebody? Well, you have to have an apparatus to enforce that law, right? The law doesn't mean anything if employers can fire people for joining a union and if the employer doesn't suffer any consequences for acting illegally. What's happened in the last 40 years is that the procedures by which violations of labor law are enforced have been weakened. The number of inspectors and the process by which workers can raise objections have become more cumbersome. And that basically it is so costly for people to fight illegal employer practices, and it's so slow to get a hearing, that employers have been able to violate the law to a much greater extent than they were in the past. The devotion of the political system towards the enforcement of rules is as important as the rules themselves in understanding why certain kinds of practices are or are not allowed and why certain kinds of organizations do or do not exist. There are workplaces in the United States, in some cities, many workplaces, that pay workers way below the minimum wage. And one might say, how could that be? That's illegal. You're not allowed to pay below the minimum wage. And the answer is, it is illegal, but somebody has to enforce it. And if the enforcement machinery for labor law is weak, then it pays employers to violate the law. That's true for labor law. It's true for pollution. If you don't enforce the pollution laws, it pays to pollute. Part of the reason why there's been a significant decline in unions is precisely because the laws that protect unions have been weakened. But it's also the case that employers have become much more sophisticated in attacking unions. They've adopted a whole series of strategies, often sometimes very ruthless, to undermine unions, to decertify unions once they exist, and to block them when workers try to create them. These include blatantly illegal things, firing people for engaging in union activities, but also various kinds of mandatory, things like mandatory meetings. Employers organize anti-union meetings where workers are all brought together and given a lecture about how, if a union is allowed, the employer is going to close up the shop and move it to Mexico, for example, that they will outsource the jobs, basically to intimidate workers by forcing them to participate in these mandatory propaganda sessions. Even after union victories occur, consultants are hired to help instruct employers about how they can block contracts. Less than half of unions who win certification manage to actually negotiate a contract now. That means the good faith bargaining provision of the National Labor Relations Act, the good faith bargaining is no longer enforced if only half the unions are able to negotiate a contract. And the result has been a steady decline of unions in the United States. Last bit, consequences for democracy. The decline of unions means that there's an absence of a coherent associational basis for a working class electorate. Unions are not, there's really no alternative. They're not a substitutable fact of life. In the absence of union, ordinary people simply don't have an organic associational basis to engage in collective political activity. This has resulted in reduced pressures on the Democratic Party to focus on working class interests. The fact that the Democratic Party is very supportive of Wall Street and looks after the interests of business much more than the interests of workers, in spite of what you may have heard in the political campaigns, that's true in general about the Democratic Party. That's to a significant extent due to the fact that the union movement no longer plays as central a role within the Democratic Party as it used to. And finally, and I think ultimately most crucially, the decline of unions has undermined the counterweight to the role of money in shaping political agendas. The willingness to pay has become way more important than the willingness to act. This is, in my judgment, one of the things that was behind the attack on public sector unions in Wisconsin 2 years ago. The reason why Governor Walker was so intent on destroying public sector unions, not just impeding them, but destroying them, was because of a belief, which was correct, that public sector unions played a key part in the political effectiveness of the Democratic Party in the state of Wisconsin. And if you could destroy public sector unions, you would help consolidate a longer-term stable rule by conservative forces in the state. That was especially critical in 2010 because of the ability of the state to redraw boundaries of legislative districts, both for the state and for national House of Representative legislatures. And as we saw in the results from the last election, even though a majority of people in Wisconsin voted for Democratic representatives nationally, and Democratic senators within the state, the gerrymandering resulted in a dominance in Wisconsin of elected officials from the Republican Party. A key part of the strategy for seeing that that would happen in elections was attacking unions as the collective associational basis for Democratic mobilization. Next week, we look at democracy from below and possible futures. See you then.